This is Audible.
Infinite Jest, written by David Foster Wallace. And this right here is a bull we used to call Mr. Man. Her slim thumb moves from shot to shot. The sunlight in Kentucky looks bright yellower than New England's. The trees are a meaner green, and have got weird mossy shit hanging from them. And this right here is a mule called Chet that could jump the fence and used to get at everybody's flowers out along Route 45 till Daddy had to put him down. This is a cow. This right here is Chet's mama. It's a mare. I don't recollect any kind of name except Chet's mama. Daddy let her out to neighbors that really did farm to sort of make up for folks' flowers. Gately nods studiously at each photo, trying to abide. He hasn't thought about the wraith or the wraith dream once since he woke up from the dream where Joelle was Mrs. Waite as a maternal death figure. Next life's Chet's mama. He opens his eyes wide to clear his head. Joelle's head is down, looking down at the open album from overhead. Her veil hangs loose and blank again, so close he could reach his left hand up and lift it if he wanted. The open book she's moving her hand around in gives Gately an idea he can't believe he's only having now, except he worries because he isn't left-handed, which is to say, sinistral. Joelle's got her thumb by a weird old sepia shot of the ass and hunched back of some guy scrabbling up the slope of a roof. "Uncle Lum," she says. "Mr. Riney, Lum Riney, my daddy's partner over to the shop, that breathed some kind of fume at the shop when I was little, and got strange. And now he'll always try and climb up on top of shit if you let him." He winces at the pain of moving his left arm to put a hand on her wrist to get her attention. Her wrist is thin across the top, but oddly deep, thick-seeming. Gately gets her to look at him, and takes the hand off her wrist, and uses it to mime writing awkwardly in the air, his eyes rolling a bit from the pain of it. This is his idea. He points at her, and then out the window, and circles his hand back to her. He refuses to grunt or moo to emphasize anything. His forefinger is twice the size of her thumb, as he again mimes holding an implement and writing on the air. He makes such a big, slow, obvious show of it because he can't see her eyes to be sure she gets what he's after. If a halfway attractive female so much as smiles at Don Gately as they pass on the crowded street, Don Gately, like pretty much all heterosexual drug addicts, has, within a couple blocks, mentally wooed, shacked up with, married, and had kids by that female. All in the future, all in his head, mentally dandling a young Gately on his mutton-joint knee, while this mental Mrs. G bustles in an apron she sometimes, at night, provocatively wears with nothing underneath. By the time he gets where he's going, the drug addict has either mentally divorced the female and is in a bitter custody battle for the kids, or is mentally, happily still hooked up with her in his sunset years, sitting together amid big-headed grandkids on a special porch swing modified for Gately's mass. Her legs in support hose and orthopedic shoes still damn fine. Barely having to speak to converse. Calling each other mother and papa, knowing they'll kick within weeks of each other because neither could possibly live without the other, is how bonded they've got through the years. The projective mental union of Gately and Joelle Madame Psychosis Van Dyne keeps foundering on the vision of Gately knee-dandling a kid in the huge blue or pink-bordered veil, however. Or tenderly removing the spongy clamps of Joelle's veil in moonlight on their honeymoon in Atlantic City and discovering just, like, one eye in the middle of her forehead. Or a horrific Churchill face or something.
350.
So, the addictive, mental, long-range fantasy gets shaky. But he still can't help envisioning the old ex with Joelle well-veiled and crying out, "And lo," in that empty, compelling way, at the moment of orgasm. The closest Gately'd ever come to exing a celebrity was the ragingly addicted nursing student with the head-banging loft, who'd borne an incredible resemblance to the young Dean Martin. Having Joelle share personal, historical snapshots with Gately leads his mind right over the seconds wall to envision Joelle, hopelessly smitten with the heroic Don G,
volunteering to bonk the guy in the hat outside the room over the head and sneak Gately and his tube and catheter out of St. E's in a laundry cart or whatever, saving him from the BPD finest or federal crew cuts or whatever direr legal retribution the guy in the hat might represent. Or else, selflessly offering to give him her veil and a big dress and let him hold the catheter under the moo-moo and sashay right out while she huddles under the covers in impersonation of Gately, romantically endangering her recovery and radio career and legal freedom, all out of a Liebenstadt-type consuming love for Gately. This last fantasy makes him ashamed. It's so cowardly. And even contemplating a romantic thing with a clueless newcomer is shameful. In Boston AA, newcomer seducing is called 13th stepping.
351.
And is regarded as the province of true bottom feeders. It's predation. Newcomers come in so whacked out, clueless and scared, their nervous systems still on the outside of their bodies and throbbing from detox, and so desperate to escape their own interior, to lay responsibility for themselves at the feet of something as seductive and consuming as their former friend, the substance. To avoid the mirror AA hauls out in front of them, to avoid acknowledging their old dear friend, the substance's betrayal and grieving it, plus, let's not even mention the mirror and vulnerability issues of a newcomer that has to wear a UHID veil. One of Boston AA's stronger suggestions is that newcomers avoid all romantic relationships for at least a year. So somebody with some sober time, predating and trying to seduce a newcomer, is almost tantamount to rape, is the Boston consensus. Not that it isn't done, but the ones that do it never have the kind of sobriety anybody else respects or wants for themselves. A 13th stepper is still running from the mirror himself. Not to mention that a staffer, seducing a new resident he's supposed to be there to help, would be dicking over Pat Modisian and Ennett House on a grand scale. Gately sees it's probably no accident that his vividest Joelle fantasies are coincident with flight from finest and legal responsibility fantasies. That his head's real fantasy is this newcomer helping him avoid, escape, and run, joining him later in, like, Kentucky on a modified port swing. He's still pretty new himself, wanting somebody else to take care of his mess, somebody else to keep him out of his various cages. It's the same delusion as the basic addictive substance delusion, basically. His eyes roll up in his head at disgust with himself and stay there. I went down the hall to take out the tobacco and brush my teeth and rinse out the spiritine can, which had gotten an unpleasant crust along the sides. The subdorm halls were curved and had no corners as such, but you can see at most 3 doors and the jamb of the 4th from any point in the hall before the curve extrudes into your line of sight. I wondered briefly whether it was true that small children believed their parents could see them even around corners and curves. The high winds moan and doors rattle were worse in the uncarpeted hall. I could hear faint sounds of early morning weeping in certain rooms beyond my line of sight. Lots of the top players start the AM with a quick fit of crying, then are basically hale and well-wrapped for the rest of the day. The walls of the subdorm's hallways are dinner mint blue. The walls of the rooms themselves are cream. All the woodwork is dark and varnished, as is the galoche that runs below all ETA ceilings, and the dominant odor in the hallways is always a mixture of varnish and tincture of benzoin. Someone had left a window open by the sinks in the boys' room, and a hump of snow lay on the sill, and on the floor beneath the window by the sink on the end, whose hot water pipe shrieks, was a parabolic dusting of snow, already melting at the apex. I turned on the lights, and the exhaust fan kicked on with them. For some reason, I could barely stand its sound. When I put my head out the window, the wind came from nowhere and everywhere, the snow swirling in funnels and eddies, and there were little grains of ice in the snow. It was brutally cold. Across the east courts, the paths were obscured, and the pine's branches were near horizontal under the snow's weight. Schtitz transom, an observation tower, looked menacing. It was still dark and snow-free on the lee side facing ComEd. The sight of distant ATH-SCME fans displacing great volumes of snowy air northward is one of the better winter views from our hilltop. But visibility was now too poor to make out the fans, and the liquid hiss of the snow was too total to make out whether the fans were even on. The headmaster's house wasn't much more than a humped shape off by the north tree line. But I could picture poor C.T. at the living room window in leather slippers and scotch plaid robe, seeming to pace even when standing still, raising and lowering the antenna of the phone in his hand, with several calls out already to Logan, MIA Dorval. Weathernet 9000's recorded update, heavy-browed figures in Quebec's ONANTA office, C.T.'s forehead a washboard and lips moving soundless as he brainstormed his way toward a state of total worry. I brought my head back in when I could no longer feel my face. I made my little ablutions. I hadn't had to go to the bathroom in a serious way in 3 days. The digital display up next to the ceiling's intercom read, 11:18, Eastern Standard Time, 0456. When the whap-whap of the bathroom door subsided, I heard a quiet voice with an odd tone farther up around the curve of the hallway. It turned out that good old Ortho Stice was sitting in a bedroom chair in front of a hall window. He was facing the window. The window was closed, and he had his forehead up against the glass, either talking or chanting to himself very quietly. The whole lower part of the window was fogged with his breath. I came up behind him, listening. The back of his head was that shark belly gray white of crew cut so short the scalp shows through. I was more or less right behind his chair. I couldn't tell whether he was talking to himself or chanting something. He didn't turn around even when I rattled my toothbrush in the NASA glass. He had on his classic darkness wear, black sweatshirt, black sweatpants, on which he'd had a red and gray ETA silkscreened down both legs. His feet were bare on the cold floor. I was standing right beside the chair, and he still didn't look up. "Who's that now?" he said, staring straight ahead through the window. "Hi, Orth." "Hal, you're up kind of early." I rattled my toothbrush a little to indicate a shrug. "You know, up and about." "What's the matter?" "What do you mean?" I asked. "Your voice. Shoot, are you crying? What's the matter?" My voice had been neutral and a bit puzzled. "I'm not crying, Orth." "Well, then." Stice breathed onto the window. He reached up without moving his head and scratched the back of his crew cut. "Up and around. We going to play some foreigners out there today, or what?" For the past 10 days, I'd always felt worst in the early a.m. before dawn. There's something elementally horrific about waking before dawn. The window was unobscured above the darkness's breathline. The snow wasn't swirling or pummeling the window, as much on the building's east side, but the lee side's absence of wind showed just how hard new snow was coming down. It was like a white curtain, endlessly descending. The sky was lightening here on the east side, a paler gray-white, not unlike Stice's crew cut. I realized that from his position he could see only condensed breath on the window, no reflections. I made a few grotesque, distended, pop-eyed faces at him behind his back. They made me feel worse. I rattled the brush. "Well, if we do, it's not going to be out there. It's drifting about up to the tape on the West Nets. They'll have to try to get us indoors somewhere." Stice breathed. "There's no indoor places got 36 quarts, Inc. Winchester Club's got 12 is maybe the most. Fucking Mount Auburn's only got 8. They'll have to move us around to different sites. It's a pain in the ass, but Schtitz done it before. I think the real variable will be whether the Quebec kids got into Logan last night, before whenever it was this hit." "Logan will be shut down, you're saying?" But I think we'd have heard if they got in last night. Freer and Strzok were keeping tabs on an FAA link ever since supper, Mario said.
Boys are looking to get X'd by some slow-witted, hairy-legged foreign girls or what?
My guess is they're stuck up at Dorval. I'll bet CT is on the case even now. Get some sort of announcement at breakfast, probably. This was a clear opening for the darkness to do a quick CT impression, wondering aloud over the phone to the Quebecois coach whether he, CT, should press for them to charter ground transport from Montreal, or else, rather, urge them not to risk travel through the concavity in a storm, in such a generous but disappointed gesture, the Quebecois would think busing the 400 clicks to Boston in a blizzard was his own generous idea. CT wholly open, opening all different psych strategies to the coach's inspection, with a frantic ruffling sound of the coach's French-English dictionary loud in the phone's background. But Stice just sat there with his forehead against the glass. His bare feet were tapping some sort of rhythm on the floor. The hallway was freezing, and his toes had a faint blue tinge. He blew air out of his lips in a tight sigh, making his fat cheeks flap a little. We called this his horse sound.
Were you talking to yourself out here, or chanting, or what?
A silence ensued.
Heard this one joke, Stice said finally.
Let's hear it.
You want to hear it?
I could use a quality laugh right now, Dark, I said.
You too?
Another silence ensued. Two different people were weeping at different pitches behind closed doors. A toilet flushed on the second floor. One of the weepers was nearly skirling, an inhuman keening sound. There was no way to tell which ETA male it was, which door back down past the wall's curve. The darkness scratched the back of his head again without moving his head. His hands looked almost luminous against the black sleeves.
There's these three statisticians gone duck hunting, he said.
He paused.
They're like statisticians by trade.
I'm with you so far.
And they gone off hunting duck, and they're hunkered down in the muck of a duck blind for hunting, in waders and hats and all, your top-of-the-line Winchester double-aughts and so on. And they're quacking into one of them kazoos duck hunters always quack into.
Duck calls, I said.
There you go.
Stice tried to nod against the window.
Well, and here comes this one duck come flying on by overhead.
Their quarry, the object of their being out there.
Damn straight. They're raising debt, and what have you, and they're getting set to blast the son of a whore into feathers and goo, Stice said. And the first statistician, he brings up his whinny and lets go, and the recoil goes and knocks him back on his ass, curse splat in the muck, but he's missed the duck, just low, they saw. And so the second statistician, he up and fires in, and back he goes too on his ass too. These whinnies got a fucker of a recoil on them. And back on his ass the second one goes, from firing, and they see his shot goes just high.
Misses the duck as well.
Misses her. Just high. At which, and then the third statistician commences to whooping and jumping up and down to beat the band, hollering, "We got him, boys! We done got him!"
Someone is crying out in a bad dream and someone else is yelling for quiet. I wasn't even pretending to laugh. Stice didn't seem to expect me to. He shrugged without moving his head. His forehead had not once left the cold glass. I stood next to him in silence and held my NASA glass with a toothbrush and looked out over the top of Stice's head through the window's upper half. The snowfall was intense and looked silky. The East Court's pavilion's green canvas roof bowed ominously down, its white Gatorade logo obscured. A figure was out there, not under the shelter of the pavilion, but sitting in the bleachers behind the East Show Courts, leaning back with his elbows on one level and bottom on the next, and feet stretched out below, not moving, wearing what seemed to be puffy and bright enough to be a coat, but getting buried by snow, just sitting there. It was impossible to tell the person's age or sex. Church spires off in Brookline were darkening as the sky lightened behind them. The beginning of dawn looked like moonlight through the snow. Several people were at their vehicles, windshields with scrapers down along Commonwealth Avenue. Their images were tiny and dark and fluttered. The avenue's line of buried parked cars looked like igloo after igloo, some sort of Eskimo tract housing thing. It had never before snowed like this in mid-November. A snow-covered B-train labored uphill like a white slug. It seemed clear that the T would be suspending roots before long. The snow and cold sunrise gave everything a confected quality. The portcullis between the driveway and the parking lot was half up, probably to keep it from being frozen closed. I couldn't see who was in the portcullis' security booth. The attendants always came and went, most of them from the Ennett House place, trying to recover. The flagpole's two flags were frozen and stuck right out straight, turning stiffly from side to side in the wind, like someone in a neck brace instead of flapping. The ETA physical post mailbox just inside the portcullis had a mohawk of snow. The whole scene had an indescribable pathos to it. Stice's fogged breath kept me from seeing anything closer than the mailbox and East Courts. The light was starting to diffract into colors at the perimeter of Stice's breath fog on the window. Shocked heard that joke down at the cranial place, from some BU fella with just terrible facial pain, he said. Stice said. I'm going to go ahead and ask the question, D-Man. It's a statistics joke. You got to know your medials, mains, and modes. I get the joke, Orth. The question is, how come you've got your forehead all up against the window like that, when your breath's keeping you from seeing anything? What are you trying to look at? And isn't your forehead getting kind of cold? Stice didn't nod. He made his hoarse sound again. He had always had the face of a fat man on a fit man's lean body. I hadn't noticed before that he had an odd little teardrop of extra flesh low down on his right jowl, like a bit of skin with mole aspirations. He said, "The forehead stopped feeling cold a couple of hours back, when I lost all my feeling in it." You've been sitting here with bare feet and your forehead against the glass for a couple hours? More like four, I think. I could hear a night custodial crew laughing and clanking a bucket right below us. Only one was laughing. It was Kinkle and Brant. My next question's pretty obvious then, Orth. He gave another awkward shrug that didn't involve his head. Well, it's sort of embarrassing here, Ink, he said. He paused. It's stuck, is what it is. Your forehead stuck to the window? Best as I can recollect, I wake up. It's just after 0100. Fucking coils having them discharges again. And there's no sleeping through that, boy. I shudder to think, Orth. And Coyle, of course, just doesn't even hit the light, just hauls out a fresh sheet from the stack under his bunk and goes right back to sawing logs. And I'm wide awake by this point in time, though, and then I couldn't get back under. Couldn't get back to sleep. Something's real wrong, I can tell, the darkness said. Pre-fundraiser nerves? The Whataburger coming up? You feel yourself starting to climb plateaus. Starting to play the way you came here hoping one day to play. And part of you doesn't believe it. It feels wrong. I went through this. Believe me, I can under... Stice automatically tries to shake his head and then gave a small cry of pain. Not that. None of that. Long fucking story. I'm not even sure I'd want anybody to believe it. Forget that part. The point's I'm up there. I'm lying there real sweaty and hot and jittered. I jump on down and got a chair and bring it out here to sit where it's cool. And where you don't have to lie there and contemplate Coyle's sheet slowly ripening under his bunk, I said, shuddering a little. And it's just starting to snow then, out. It's about maybe like 0100. I thought how I'd just sit and watch the snow a little, and settle on down and then go grab some sack down in the VR. He scratched at the reddening back of his scalp again. And as you watched, you rested your head pensively against the glass for just a second.
And that was all she wrote. Forgot the forehead was sweated up. Whammo. Ka-twanged my own self. Just like, remember when Raider and them got Ingersoll to touch his tongue on that net post last New Year's? Stuck air fucking tight as that tongue, Hal. Hell of a lot more total stuck area, too, than Ingersoll. He only did lose that smidgen off the tip. Ink, I tried to pull her off her about 02:30, and there was this fucking sound. This sound and a feeling like the skin'll give before the bind will, sure. Frozen stuck. And this here's more skin than I care to say goodbye to, Buddy Ruff. He was speaking just above a whisper. Jesus. And you've just been sitting here all this time? Well, shit, I was embarrassed. And it never got quite bad enough to yell out. I kept thinking if it gets a little worse, I'll go on and yell out. And then along about 03, I quit feeling the forehead altogether. You've just been sitting here waiting for someone to happen along, chanting quietly to keep up your courage.
I was just praying like hell it wouldn't be Pimulus. God only knows what that son of a whore to thunk of to do to me here, all helpless and immobilated. And Trolch is sawing logs just inside that door there with his fucking mic and cable and ambitions. I've been praying he don't wake up. And let's don't even mention that son of a bitch Freer. I looked at the door.
But that's Axe Handle's single. What would Trolch be doing sleeping in Axe Handle's room? Ortho shrugged.
Trust that I've had plenty of time to listen and identify different folks' snores, Ink.
I looked from Stice to Axford's door and back. So you've just been sitting here listening to sleep noises and watching your breath expand and freeze on the window, I said. Imagining it seemed somehow unendurable. Me just sitting there, stuck, well before sunrise, alone, too embarrassed to call out, my own exhalations fouling the window and denying me even a view to divert attention from the horror. I stood there horrified, admiring the darkness's ballsy calm.
There was a kind of real bad half hour when my upper lip up and got stuck too in the breath, when the breath froze. But I breathed the sucker loose. I breathed real hot and fast, goddamn near hyper-V'd. I was scared if I passed out, I'd slump on forward and the whole face would get stuck. Goddamn forehead's bad enough.
I put my toothbrush and NASA glass down on the cantilevered vent module. Room's vents were recessed, hallway vents protrusive. ETA's annular heating system produced a lubricated hum I had stopped really hearing years ago. The headmaster's house still had oil heat. It always sounded like a maniac was hammering at the pipes far below.
Dark, prepare yourself mentally, I said. I'm going to help pull you loose.
Stice didn't seem to hear this. He seemed oddly preoccupied for a man occlusively sealed to a frozen window. He was feeling at the back of his head with real vigor, which is what he did when he was preoccupied.
You believe in shit, Hal?
Shit?
I don't know. Little kid shit. Teleconniption. Ghosts. Para-abnormal shit.
Just going to get around behind you and yank and we'll pop you right off, I said.
Somebody did come by before, he said. There was somebody standing back there about maybe an hour back, but he just stood there. And then he went away. Or it.
A full-body shiver.
It'll be like that last little bit of ankle tape.
We'll pull you back so hard and fast you won't feel a thing.
I'm getting these real unpleasant memories of that piece of Ingersoll's tongue on Nine's net post that stayed there till spring.
This is no saliva at sub-zero metal situation, Dark. This is some freakish occlusive seal. Glass doesn't conduct heat like metal conducts heat.
There ain't too fucking much heat involved in this window right here, Buddy Ruff.
And I'm not sure what you mean, paranormal. I believed in vampires when I was small. Himself allegedly used to see his father's ghost on stairways sometimes, but then again, toward the end, he used to see black widow spiders in his hair, too, and claimed I wasn't speaking sometimes when I was sitting right there speaking to him. So we kind of wrote it all off. Orth, I guess I don't know what to think about paranormal shit.
Then, plus, I think something bit me. On the back of the head here,
Some bug that knew I was helpless and couldn't see?
Stice dug again at the red area behind his ear. There was a kind of weltish bump there. It wasn't in a vampire-related area of the neck.
And good old Mario says he's seen paranormal figures, and he's not kidding, and Mario doesn't lie, I said.
So, belief-wise, I don't know what to think.
Subadronic particles behave ghostishly. I think I withhold all prejudgment on the whole thing.
Well, all right, then. It was good it was you come by then.
The big thing's going to be to stiffen the old neck, Dark, to avoid whiplash. We'll pull you off there like a cork from a bottle of Moet. Pull my sorry ass off here, Inc., and I'll take and show you some para-abnormal shit that'll shake your personal tree butt good, Stice said, bracing.
Ain't said nothing to nobody but Lyle about it, and I'm sick of the secretness of it. You won't pre-formulize any judgments, Inc., I know.
You're gonna be fine, I said. I got right behind Stice and bent slightly and got an arm around his chest. His wooden chair creaked as I braced my knee against it. Stice began breathing fast and hard. His parotidic jowls flapped a little as he breathed. Our cheeks were almost pressed together. I told him I was going to pull on the count of three. I actually pulled on two, so he couldn't brace himself. I pulled back as hard as I could, and after a stutter of resistance, Stice pulled back with me. There was a horrible sound. The skin of his forehead distended as we yanked his head back. It stretched and distended until a sort of shelf of stretched forehead flesh, half a meter long, extended from his head to the window. The sound was like some sort of elastic from hell. The dermis of Stice's forehead was still stuck fast, but the abundant loose flesh of Stice's bulldog face had risen and gathered to stretch and connect his head to the window. And for a second I saw what might be considered Stice's real face, his features as they would be if not encased in loose, jowly prairie flesh. As every millimeter of spare flesh was pulled up to his forehead and stretched, I got a glimpse of Stice as he would appear after a radical facelift. A narrow, fine-featured, and slightly rodential face, aflame with some sort of revelation. Looked out at the window from beneath a pink visor of stretched, spare skin. All this took place in less than a second. For just an instant, we both stayed there, straining backward, listening to the little Rice Krispie sound of his skin's collagen bundle stretching and popping. His chair was leaning way back on its two rear legs. Then Stice shrieked in pain.
Jesus God, put it back!
The little second face's blue eyes protruded like cartoon eyes. The fine little thin-lipped second mouth was a round coin of pain and fear.
Put it back! Put it back! Put it back!
Stice yelled. I couldn't just let go, though, for fear that the elastic stretch would snap Stice forward into the window and send his face through the glass. I eased him forward, watching the chair's front legs descend slowly to the floor, and the tension of the forehead skin decreased, and Stice's full, fleshy, round face reappeared over the small second face and covered it. And we eased him forward until nothing but a few centimeters of decalogenated forehead skin hanging and sagging at about eyelash level remained as evidence of the horrific stretch.
Jesus God! Stice panted.
You are really and truly stuck, Orph.
Fuck me skating, did that ever hurt?
I tried to rotate a kink out of my shoulder. We're going to have to thaw it off, Dark.
You're not getting close to this forehead with a saw, bud. I'll sit right here till spring first, see if I don't.
Then Jim Trolch's towering AM cowlick and then face and fist emerged through Axford's doorway, just over Stice's hunched shoulder. Stice had been right. Being in somebody else's room even after lights out was an infraction. Staying there overnight was too far out even to mention in the regulations.
"Reports of screaming have reached us here in the Eyewitness News Center,"
Trolch said into his fist.
"The fuck out of here, Trolch,"
Stice said. "Thaw, Ortho. Warm water. Heat the window. Hot water. Dissolve the adhesion. Heating pad. Hot pack from Loach's office or something."
Loach's door can't be dickied, Stice said. Don't wake him up on fundraiser day yet.
Trolch extended the fist.
Reports of high-pitched screams have led this reporter to an unfolding scene of dramatic crisis, and we're going to attempt to get a word with the youngster at the center of all the commotion.
Tell him to pop down and get back with that hand, or so help me Jesus, Hal.
The darkness accidentally put his forehead against the window here when it was wet, and it froze, and he's been out here stuck all night, I told Trolch, ignoring the big fist he held to my face. I squeezed Stice's shoulder. I'll go get Brandt to rig something warm. It was as if some tacit agreement had been reached, not even to bring up Trolch's being in Axford's room, or where Axford was. It was hard to know which would be more disturbing, Axford's not being in his room all night, or Axford being in there behind the ajar door, meaning Trolch and Axford had both spent the night in one small single with exactly one bed. The universe seemed to have aligned itself so that even acknowledging it would violate some tacit law.
Trolch seemed oblivious to any appearance of impropriety or unthinkable possibilities.
It was hard to imagine he'd be this obnoxious if he felt he had something to be discreet about.
He was standing on tiptoe to see over the window's breathline, one hand cupped over his ear, as if to hold a headset. He whistled softly.
Plus, in addition, now reports of mind-boggling snowfall are coming into the news center.
I grabbed my toothbrush and NASA glass from the vent's protrusion. Since the Battelle caper, only the worst kind of naïf leaves his toothbrush unattended around ETA.
352.
Keep an eye on Stice and my NASA glass right there, Jim, if you would.
Any comment on the mixture of pain, cold, embarrassment, and weather-related feelings you must be feeling? Mr. Stice, is it?
Don't leave me immobilated with Trolch, man, Hal. He's going to make me talk to his hand.
A weather-related drama unfolding around the original plight of an embarrassed man trapped by his own forehead,
Trolch was saying into his fist, facing his own reflection in the window, trying with the other big hand to quash the cowlick as I trotted and slid to a stop in my socks, just past the door to the stairwell.
Kenkel and Brandt were ageless, in the special desiccated way janitors are ageless, somewhere between 35 and 60. They were inseparable and essentially unemployable. Boredom had years ago led us to lateral Alice Moore's minimally crypto-protected employee files, and Brandt's file had listed his SBIQ as submoronic to moronic. He was bald and somehow at once overweight and wiry. Both right and left temples carried red, jagged surgical scars of unknown origin. His effective range consisted of different intensities of grin. He lived with Kenkel in an attic apartment in Roxbury Crossing, overlooking Madison Park High School's locked and cordoned playground, famed site of unsolved ritual mutilations in the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken. His major attraction for Kenkel seemed to consist in the fact that he neither walked away nor interrupted when Kenkel was speaking. Even in the stairwell I could hear Kenkel discoursing on their Thanksgiving plans and directing Brandt's mop work. Kenkel was technically black, as in negroid, though he was more the burnt sienna color of a spoiled pumpkin. But his hair was a black person's hair, and he wore it in thick dreadlocks that looked like a crown of wet cigars. An academic diamond in the very rough Roxbury Crossing, he'd received his doctorate in low-temperature physics from UMass at 21, and taken a prestigious sinecure at the U.S. Office of Naval Research. Then at 23, had been court-martialed out of the ONR for offenses that changed each time you asked him. Some event between 21 and 23 seemed to have broken him at several strategic points, and he'd retreated from Bethesda back to the front stoop of his old Roxbury Crossing apartment building, where he read Baha'i texts whose jackets he covered with intricately folded newspaper, and spat spectacular parabolas of quivering phlegm into New Dudley Street. He was dark-freckled and carbuncular and afflicted with excess phlegm. He was an incredible spitter, and alleged his missing incisors had been removed for facilitating the expectoratory process. We all suspected he was either hypomanic or dreen-addicted or both.
His expression was very serious at all times. He discoursed non-stop to poor Brant, using spit as a sort of conjunction between clauses. He spoke loudly because they both wore earplugs of expanding foam. People's nightmare cries gave them the phantods. Their custodial technique consisted of Kenkel spitting with pinpoint accuracy onto whatever surface Brant was to clean next, and Brant, trotting like a fine hunting dog from glob to glob, listening and grinning, laughing when appropriate. They were moving away from me down the hall toward the second floor's east window, Brant making great shining arcs with his doll's head mop, Kenkel pulling the gunmetal bucket and lobbing signifying phlegm over Brant's bent back.
"And then the Yuletide season, Brant, my friend, Brant, Christmas, Christmas morning. What is the essence of Christmas morning but the childish coeval of venereal interface for a child? A present, Brant. Something you have not earned and which formerly was out of your possession is now in your possession. Can you sit there and try to say there is no symbolic relation between unwrapping a Christmas present and undressing a young lady?"
Brant bobbed and mopped, uncertain whether to laugh. Himself had met Kenkel and Brant on the tee. Kenkel and Brant apparently rode the tee at night, recreationally, trying somehow to make it up to Enfield from the back bay via the orange line,
353,
and somewhat the worse for wear. Kenkel and Brant not only got himself onto the right color train and kept him propped up between them all the way up the eternity of Commonwealth Avenue, they'd seen him safely down the T-stop's steep iron stairs, and across traffic, and up the hill's serpentine driveway to the portcullis, and had been invited in, at 0200, by himself, to continue whatever low-temperature discussion he and Kenkel had been having, as Brant carried himself up the hill in a fireman's carry. Kenkel recalls that night's discussion being about the human nose as an erectile organ. But the only real sure bet is that it was one-sided. And the duo had ended up being cast as black-veiled, no-style attendants in himself's zero-gravity tea ceremony, and had been menially employed at ETA ever since, though always on the graveyard shift, since Mr. Hardy loathed Kenkel with a passion. Kenkel hawked and hit a small strip of dust at the crease of baseboard and floor that the mop's arc had missed.
"For I'm a missionary man, Brant, is what I am. Brant, as in, give me the straightforward venereal interface of missionary congress, or give me nihil and zilch. You know what I'm saying? Give me your best thoughts on alternative positions, Brant. Brant, for me, for my part at least, I say nix and nihil on the rear entry, or you might hear it termed dog or canine style interface, so favored in huts, blue cartridges, tantric etchings. Brant, it's animalistic." "Why? Why, you say? Brant, it is an essentially hunched way to have interface. She hunches, you hunch over her. Inordinately too much hunching, to my own way of..."
It was Brant who heard me as I came up behind him in socks, trying to keep to the drier patches. I almost slipped twice. It was still coming down hard outside the east window.
"Otto Brant here!"
Brant called to me, extending a hand, though I was still several meters away. Kenkel's dreadlocks protruded from under a plaid hat. He turned with Brant and raised his hand, Indianishly, in greeting.
"Good Prince Hal, up and dressed in dawn's early."
"Let me introduce myself," Brant said.
I shook his hand.
"It is Socks and Toothbrush, BTA's Atheling Brant, whom I will wager rarely hunches."
"The darkness needs you guys upstairs ASAP," I said, trying to dry a sock against a pant leg. "Dark's face is stuck to the window, and he's in terrible pain, and we couldn't pull it off, and it's going to take hot water, but not too hot." I indicated the bucket at Kenkel's feet. I noticed Kenkel's shoes didn't match.
"What may we ask is so amusing, then?" Kenkel asked.
"Name's Brant, and pleased to meet you,"
Brant said, out with the hand again. He dropped the mop where Kenkel pointed. "Trolch's with him now, but he's in a bad way," I said, shaking Brant's hand.
"We are en route," Kenkel said. "But why the hilarity?"
"What hilarity?" Kenkel looked from me to Brant to me.
What hilarity, he says. Your face is a hilarity face. It's working hilariously. At first it merely looked amused. Now it is openly cachinnated. You are almost doubled over. You can barely get your words out. You're all but slapping your knee. That hilarity, good Prince Athling Howe. I thought all you players were compadre mundos in civilian life.
Brant beamed as he backed down the hall. Kankel pushed his plaid cap back to scratch at some sort of eruption at the hairline. I drew myself up to full height and consciously composed my face into something deadly somber. How about now? Brant had the custodial closet unlocked. There was the sound of a metal bucket being filled at the closet's industrial tap. Kankel brought his cap back forward and narrowed his eyes at me. He came up close. His eyelashes were clotted with small, crisp, yellow flakes. There were struck-like facial cysts in various stages of development. Kenkel's breath always smelled vaguely of egg salad. He felt at his mouth speculatively for a moment and said,
"Somewhere's now between amused and catchinated. Mirthful, perhaps. The crinkled eyes, the dimples of mirth, the exposed gums. We can bounce this off Brant's best thinking as well if..."
From directly overhead came a stealing, rattling,
"Yeah!"
from Stice. I was feeling at my face. Some doors opened along the hall, heads protruding. Brant had a full metal bucket and was trying to run to the stairwell, the weight of the bucket canting his shoulder and steaming water sloshing onto the clean floor. He stopped with his hand on the stairwell door and looked back over his shoulder at us, reluctant to proceed without Kenkel.
"I elect to go with Mirthful,"
Kenkel said, giving my shoulder a little squeeze as he stepped past. I heard him saying different things to the heads in the doorways all the way down the hall.
"Jesus," I said.
Socks or no, I went forward into the really wet mopped area and tried to make out my face's expression in the east window. It was now too light, though, outside, off all the snow. I looked sketchy and faint to myself, tentative and ghostly against all that blazing white. Partial transcript of weather-delayed meeting between 1. Mr. Rodney Tyne Sr., Chief of Unspecified Services and White House Advisor on Interdependent Relations. 2. Ms. Maureen Hooley, Vice President for Children's Entertainment, Interlace, Tell Entertainment, Inc. 3. Mr. Carl E. Buster Yee, Director of Marketing and Product Perception, Glad Flaccid Receptacle Corporation. 4. Mr. R. Tyne Jr., Deputy Regional Coordinator, U.S. Office of Unspecified Services. And 5. Mr. P. Tom Veals, Viney and Veals Advertising Unlimited, 8th Floor State House Annex, Boston, Massachusetts, USA. 20th of November, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Mr. Tyne Sr.
Tom? Buster? Mo?
Mr. Veals.
Ah, the G.
Mr. Yee.
Rod?
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Guys?
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Afternoon, Chief.
Mr. Tyne Sr. Miss Hooley.
Glad you could finally get in, Rod. May I say we're all extremely excited on our end.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Never seen snow like this. Any of you ever seen snow remotely approaching anything like this?
Mr. Veals sneezes.
Fucking town.
Mr. Yee.
Like an extra dimension out there. Less an element than its own dimension.
Someone, shoes making a squelching noise under the table.
Mr. Yee. With its own rules, laws, awe-inspiring, fearsome.
Mr. Veals.
Cold, wet, deep, slippery, more like.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping the edge of a ruler against the tabletop.
Their limo in from Logan did a 180 on Starro. Mr. Yee was just telling.
Mr. Tyne Sr., tapping a telescoping weatherman's pointer against the edge of the tabletop.
So what's the poop? The skinny. What are we talking?
Ms. Hooley. Spot ready for previewing. We need your go. I'm in from Phoenix via New York. Mr. Yee.
I'm in from Ohio, choppered up from New York with Mo here.
Miss Hooley.
Spot's masters in the post-production lab down at V&V, all ready except for some final bugs with the matting. Mr. Veals.
Lorraine says we need you and Busta's green light to disseminate.
Ms. Hooley. You and the titular sponsor here greenlight it. We can have disseminatable product by the end of the weekend. Mr. Veals sneezes.
Assuming this fucking snow doesn't shut down our power.
Mr. Tyne Sr., motioning with weatherman's pointer to USO stenographer to transcribe verbatim.
Seen it yet, Buster?
Mr. Yee.
Negative, Rod. Just in with these folks here. Kennedy completely socked in. No added charter or chopper. I'm sitting here cherry.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping edge of ruler on tabletop.
How'd you fare getting up here, sir, if I may?
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Mountain comes to Mohammed, eh, Tom?
Mr. Veals.
How come I only came two clicks down here and I'm the one with the fucking cold?
Mr. Tyne Jr.
I've been here in Boston as well.
Mr. Veals, checking connections on Infernitron 210Y digital player and viewer system.
So, shall we?
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Okay, for the record, Mo. Demographic target?
Ms. Hooley. Ages 6 to 10 with marginally reduced efficacy, 4 to 6, and 10 to 13. Let's say targets 4 to 12, white, native English-speaking, median income and above, capacity on Kruger abstraction scale, 3 or above, refers to notes. Advertible attention span of 16 seconds, with a geometric fall-off commencing at 13 seconds. Mr. Tyne Sr.
Spot length?
Ms. Hooley. 30 seconds with a traumatic graphic at 14 seconds. Mr. Veals.
Hawks phlegm.
Mr. Yee.
Proposed insertion vehicle, Mo?
Ms. Hooley. The Mr. Bouncy Bounce Show, spontaneous dissemination at 1600, Monday to Friday, 1500 Central and Mountain. Cream of the crop. 82 share on spontaneous receptions for the slot. Mr. Yee.
Any data on what percentage of total viewing in the slot is spontaneous versus recorded cartridge?
Miss Hooley. We had 47% plus or minus 2 as of year of the You Shit You 2007. That's the last year the data's firmed up for.
Mr. Tyne Sr. So, say 40% of total viewing for the spot.
Mr. Yee.
Give or take. Impressive.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
So, check, check, check. We got rough costs?
Mr. Yee.
Production just over half a meg. Post-production,
Mr. Veals.
Bupkis, 150K before matting.
Mr. Yee.
I might add that Tom's pro bonoing his part of the production.
Mr. Veals.
So, you all ready to eyeball this or what?
Miss Hooley. Since Mr. BB's contracted as a no public service spot vehicle, dissemination charge will come out around 180K per slot.
Mr. Yee.
Which we're still of the position, this seems a bit steep.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
The upcoming year's GLAAD's year, Buster. You wanted the year. You want the year of GLAAD to be the year half the nation stopped doing anything but staring bug-eyed at some sinister cartridge while little whirls went around in their eyes until they died of starvation in the middle of their own
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Shut up, Rodney. And quit with the ruler tapping. Buster, I'm sure, knows the incredible goodwill that's even now accruing from their proud sponsorship of probably the most important public service spots ever conceived, given the potential threat here.
Mr. Veals sneezes twice in abrupt succession, comment unintelligible. Mr. Tyne Sr. taps telescoping weatherman's pointer on edge of tabletop.
Righto, then. The spot itself, then. The spokesfigure icon thing. Still the, singing Kleenex?
Mr. Yee.
The what was it, Frankie, the no thanky hanky? Warning kids to say no thanky to unlabeled or suspicious cartridges?
Ms. Hooley clears throat. Tom? Mr. Tyne Jr. taps ruler on edge of tabletop. Mr. Veals hawks.
No! Had to shit-can the dancing Kleenex after the response group's test data were analyzed. Various problems. The phrase, no thanky, itself perceived as archaic, uncool, crotchety adult. Too New England or something.
summoned images of a leathery-faced old guy in overalls. Took attention away from what they're supposed to say no thanks to. Plus, phrase recognition data was way under minimum slogan parameters.
Ms. Hooley. Problems with the icon itself. Mr. Veals, blowing nose one nostril at a time.
Kids hated Frankie the Hanky. We're talking levels past ambivalence. Associated the hanky with snot, basically. The word booger kept coming up. The singing didn't help.
Miss Hooley. Which is why in this case, thank God for response group testing.
Mr. Yee. This business will make you old.
Mr. Veals.
Had to go back and completely reboot at square one.
Mr. Yee.
Does anyone else smell a peculiar citrusy floral odor?
Miss Hooley. Tom's boys have been at it 24/7. We're extremely excited at the result. Mr. Veals.
It's previewable but rough. Not really quite there yet. The first Phil's digital's had a bug.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Phil?
Mr. Veals.
A small bug, but nasty. Dregs of a turbo virus in the graphic encoder. Phil's head kept detaching and floating off to the upper right. Not a good effect at all, given the message we want to send.
Mr. Yee.
Like orange blossoms, but with a kind of sick sweetness.
Miss Hooley. Oh, dear. Mr. Veals sneezes.
And debugging put us behind on some of the fonts, so you're going to have to use some imagination here. Has this 210 unit been downloaded for schematic matting?
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Excuse me, Phil?
Mr. Veals.
Introducing fully functional Phil, the prancing ass.
Miss Hooley. More like a mule. A burro.
A burro!
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping like mad.
An ass?
Miss Hooley. Horse characters were copyrighted by Child Search. They're Patch the Pony Who Says Nay to Stranger's Spots. Mr. Tyne Jr.
A prancing ass.
Miss Hooley. The perception of naivete and clumsiness about a mule icon provoked a kind of empathy in the response groups. Phil's not coming off as an authority figure, joy-killer type. More like a peer. So the cartridge he warns against gets none of the forbidden fruit type boost of being warned against by an authority figure. Mr. Veals.
Plus the kid market's a friggin' horror show. Near every species was copyrighted. Garfield? McGruff the freaking crime dog? Toucan Sam? The ONAN bird of prey? Let's not even get into the bears or bunnies. It was basically either an ass or a cockroach. Never again the kids market as God is my witness.
Sneezes. Miss Hooley. Once we went with the burrow, Tom opted to accentuate the clumsy incompetence factor. To almost ironize the icon. Buck teeth. Crossed eyes.
Mr. Veals. Extravagantly crossed. Like he's just been whacked with a sock full of nickels. My response was through the roof.
Miss Hooley. Ears that won't stay upright. Legs keep getting all rubbery and tangled when he tries to prance.
Mr. Veals. But prance he does.
Mr. Yee.
But surely it doesn't present itself as an ass. Surely it doesn't prance out and say, take it from me, an ass.
Mr. Veals.
A fully functional ass.
Miss Hooley. Tom's rather ingeniously played up the functionality angle. The energy and verve versus passivity angle. He's never just Phil. He's fully functional Phil. He's a blur of kid-type activity. School, playing, teleputer interfacing, prancing. Tom's got him storyboarded for a number of 30-second activity-packed little adventures. He's a goof, an iconic child, but he's active. He stands for the attraction of capacity, agency, choice. As versus the spot's animated adult who we see in a recliner, ostensibly watching the Canadian cartridge, little spirals going around and around in his eyes, as his body sort of melts, and his head starts growing and distending until the passive watching adult's image is just a huge 5 o'clock shadowed head in the recliner, his eyeballs huge and whirling. Mr. Tyne Jr. taps his ruler against the edge of the tabletop.
Mr. Veals. Let's just roll the thing for him, Mo.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
I've got to say I foresee trouble selling a certain commander-in-chief on a prancing ass as an improvement over a singing Kleenex.
Ms. Hooley. Phil's message is that not every entertainment cartridge out there is necessarily a good old safe, pre-approved interlaced tele-entertainment product. He says words reached him during his fun-filled, fully functional daily activities of a certain very wicked and sneaky cartridge that even has a little smiling face on the case. And when you first start watching it, looks like it promises to be more fun to watch than anything you've ever wished on a star or blown out a birthday cake candle for. In a thought bubble that becomes visible when Phil's ears flop down again, Mr. Veals sneezes.
Not yet matted in all the way,
Mr. Tynes Sr.
You know how he is about Kleenex.
Miss Hooley. Will be an image of an iconic cartridge case with a friendly smile and pudgy little harmless Pillsbury Doughboy arms and legs. Mr. Yee, loosening his collar.
Not the actual copyrighted Pillsbury iconic limb animation codes, though.
Mr. Veals.
Relax! More like a reference. An allusion to plumpness, cuteness. Pudgy and harmless-looking limbs is the thing.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping edge of tabletop with ruler. Mr. Tyne Sr., pointing at tapping ruler with weatherman's pointer.
You're close to losing that hand, bucko.
Miss Hooley, referring to notes. Then Phil looks up and pops the thought bubble with a needle and says, But it's a liar. This smiling cartridge is a wicked thing, lying, like the stranger who leans out of his car and offers you a ride home to your mommy and daddy, but really wants to grab you and put his sweaty hand over your mouth and lock you in the car and take you far away with him to where you'll never see your mommy, daddy, or Mr. Bouncy Bounce ever again.
Mr. Veals. Which, and here's the traumatic graphic at 14, a dock boarded new thought bubble over Phil, in which now the cartridge's limbs are like a dock worker's. It's a swart, leering cartridge with yellow fangs and long nails in a plaid cap and overalls, driving off with an animated kid's plate all screaming and horrified against the car's rear window, spirals starting to roll in the kid's eyes. Wait till you see it.
Miss Hooley. It's so scary, it's positively riveting.
Mr. Veals sneezes twice.
Stuff of fucking nightmares.
Mr. Yee. falls from chair. Mr. Tyne Jr.
Holy mackerel!
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Buster! Buster!
Miss Hooley. Mr. Yee's epileptic, severe, untreatable, happened twice on the chopper in. Stress or embarrassment brings it on. He'll be back up in a minute. Just act natural when he comes back up.
Mr. Yee, heels drumming on Terrazzo Statehouse Annex floor tile.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Jesus.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping ruler on tabletop's edge.
Jesus W. Christ!
Mr. Tyne Sr., rising, indicating tapping ruler with extended weatherman's pointer.
All right, goddammit! Give me that thing! Give it here!
Mr. Tyne Jr.
The chief!
Mr. Tyne Sr.
You heard me, goddammit! You know it drives me bats. You'll get it back when we're done.
Drives me up the wall. Always has.
What is it with you and that ruler?
Miss Hooley. Be up and back in the game in a jiff. He won't remember the fit. Just don't mention it. The embarrassment of mentioning it'll set it off again. That's why twice on the chopper. I learned the hard way. Mr. Yee.
Splar! Cuck!
Mr. Veals.
Hawking. For Christ's sake.
Miss Hooley, referring to notes. As the cartridge in the car in the thought bubble drives the splayed kid away, Phil prances a bit and warns that we don't even know for sure what the cartridge to watch out for is even about. He warns that the police only know that it's something that looks like you'd really want to watch it. He says all we know is it looks really entertaining, but that it really just wants to take away your functionality. He says we know it's Canadian.
Mr. Veals. That's why the plaid cap and the traumatic graphic. Response data indicates a plaid cap with ear flaps signifies a big C to over 70% of the spot's target. The overalls drive the association home.
Miss Hooley. At 19 seconds, fully functional Phil then dances his warning dance, a Native American come breakdance type dance we're hoping will catch on among younger dancers. His rhetorical thrust is to play it functional and safe, and make sure and check with mommy and or daddy before watching any entertainment you haven't seen before, i.e. to accept no spontaneous dissemination and play no post-delivered entertainment without checking with an authority figure. Mr. Tyne Jr.
But as a peer, more like, I'm thinking this is what I better do if I want to stay fully functional.
Mr. Yee, back upright in chair.
Somebody's mentioned the floppy ear and plastic buck teeth product tie-ins.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Jesus, Mr. Yee, are you sure you're okay?
Miss Hooley.
Ixnay on the ancient May.
Mr. Yee, sweat-soaked, looking around.
What did he mean? He didn't mean...
Mr. Tyne Sr.
God damn it, Rodney.
Mr. Yee.
Splarg.
Falls from chair. Miss Hooley clears throat.
And finally, direly, can I say direly?
Mr. Veals.
This is at 25.35 seconds.
Miss Hooley.
Emphatically warns that if Mommy and or Daddy have been observed sitting in one position in front of the home's viewer for an unusually long period of time...
Mr. Veals.
Without speaking, without responding to stimuli...
Miss Hooley.
Or acting in any way unusual, or distracted, or creepy, or spooky with respect to an entertainment on the viewer?
Mr. Veals.
We got spooky on the last pass.
Mr. Yee.
Scorg.
Miss Hooley.
That the fully functional kid'll never attempt to rouse them himself. And fully functional Phil leans way in a kind of fisheye lens close-up, and says, no way would he ever be so dumb as to even for a second plunk himself passively down and have a look at what it is his parents are so silently, creepily engrossed by. But to vacate the premises and prance as fast as he can to get a policeman, who'll know just how to cut the premises power and help Mom and Dad.
Mr. Veals.
His trademark expression is, no ho 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 way. He works it in whenever possible.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
His equivalent to the Kleenex is no thanky.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
We're ready to view, I think.
Mr. Yee, back in seat, necktie now wrapped all the way around neck like an aviator's scarf.
Still hashing out the tie-ins with Hasbro and others.
Mr. Veals.
We're all cued and ready.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Let's have a look at the sucker.
Miss Hooley.
Since Tom's too modest to say so, I should say that Tom's already storyboarded an extremely exciting, adolescent targeted version of fully functional Phil for music video and softcore disseminations, where Phil engages in a great deal more ironic self-parody, and in this version his trademark expression becomes, it's your ass, Ace.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
So let's have a look at the bastard.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Kid, your job here, from here on out, is to pipe down. Now do you...
Mr. Yee.
I've been asked to say for transcription how pleased the Glad Flaccid Receptacle Corporation is, during this potentially grave interval, to be a proud...
Mr. Veals, at the Infernitron 210 viewer.
Hit those lights over behind you, kid.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
This'll make it difficult for the transcriber to transcribe, can I say?
Mr. Yee.
This spot doesn't happen to in any way optically pulse or strobe, does it?
Mr. Veals.
Are we all set?
Mr. Tyne Sr.
So lights already.
Gately's memories of Cheers' Nom now are clearer and vivider than any memory of the Wraith dream or the whirling Wraith who said death was just everything outside you getting really slow. The implication that there might, at any given time, in any room, be whole swarms of wraiths flitting around the hospital on errands that couldn't affect anybody living, all way too fast to see, and dropping by to watch Gately's chest rise and fall at the rate of the sun. None of this has sunk in enough to give him the howlers, not in the wake of Joelle's visit and the fantasies of romance and rescue, and the consequent shame. There's now a sandy sound of gritty, sleetish stuff, wind-driven, against the room's window. The hiss of the heater, sounds of gunfire and brass bands from cartridge viewers on in other rooms. The room's other beds still empty and tightly made. The intercom gives that triple ding every few minutes. He wonders if they just do it to bug people. The fact that he couldn't even finish Ethan Frum in 10th grade English, and hasn't got clue one about where ghost words like sinistral or liebestod mean or come from, much less omatophoric. is just starting to percolate up to awareness, when there's a cold hand on his good shoulder and he opens his eyes. Not to mention ghost words, which is a real and esoteric word. He's been floating just under sleep's lid again. Joelle Van D's gone. The hand is the nurse that had changed the catheter bag. She looks hassled and unserene, and one cheekbone sticks out farther than the other, and her little slot of a mouth's got little vertical wrinkles all around it from being held tight all the time, not unlike the basically late Mrs. G's tight little mouth.
"The visitor said you requested this because of the tube."
It's a little stenographic notebook and Bic.
"Are you left-handed?"
The nurse means sinistral. She's penguin-shaped and smells of cheap soap. The notebook is stenographic because its pages turn over at the top instead of to the side. Gailey shakes his head gingerly and opens his left hand for the stuff. It makes him feel good all over again that Joelle had understood what he'd meant. She hadn't just come to tell her troubles to somebody that couldn't make human judgment noises. Shaking his head slowly, lets him see past the nurse's white hip. Ferocious Francis is sitting in the chair, but the Wraith and Ewell and Calvin Thrust had all sat in, his skinny legs uncrossed, gnarled and crew-cutted and clear-eyed behind his glasses and totally relaxed, holding his portable O2 tank, his chest rising and falling at about the rate of phone rings, watching the nurse waddle tensely out. Gailey can see a clean white tee under the open buttons of Ferocious Francis's flannel shirt. Coughing is FF's way of saying hello.
"Still sucking air, I see,"
Ferocious Francis says when the fit's passed, making sure the little blue tubes are still taped under his nose. Gailey struggles with one hand to flip the notebook open and write, "Yo," in block caps. Except there's nothing to really hold the notebook up against and write. He has to sort of balance it flat on one thigh, so he can't see what he's writing, and writing with his left hand makes him feel like a stroke victim must feel. And what he holds up at his sponsor looks more like, "You."
"Figured God needed a little help the other night, did you?"
Francis says, leaning way out to the side, to get a red bandana hanky out of a back pocket.
"What I heard..."
Gailey tries to shrug, can't, smiles weakly. His right shoulder is so thickly bandaged, it looks like a turbaned head. The old man probes a nostril and then examines the hanky with interest, just like the dream wraith did. His fingers are swollen and misshapen, and his nails are long and square and the color of old turtle shell.
"Poor sick bastard going around cutting up people's pets. Cut up the wrong people's pets. This is the way I heard it."
Gately wants to tell Ferocious Francis how he's discovered how no one second of even unnarcotized post-trauma infection pain is unendurable, that he can abide if he must. He wants to share his experience with his crocodile sponsor, and plus, now that somebody he trusts himself to need is here, Gately wants to weep about the pain and tell how bad the pain of it is, how he doesn't think he can stand it one more second.
"You saw yourself as in charge. Thought you'd step in. Protect your fellow man from his consequences. Which poor sick green in and house fuck was it?"
Gailey struggles to try and get his knee up so he can see to write. "Lentz. White wig. Always north. Always on phone." Again, it looks cuneiform, though. Illegible. Ferocious Francis blows out a nostril and replaces the little tube. The tank in his lap makes no sound. It has a little valve, but no dial or needles.
"You stepped in against six armed Hawaiians, I hear. Marshall Plan, Captain Courageous, God's personal Shane."
FF likes to send air through his nose's tubes in a mirthless burst, a kind of anti-laugh. His nose is large and cucumber-shaped and wide-pored, and pretty much its whole circulatory system is visible.
"Lenny Cubits calls me and describes the thing blow by blow job. Says I should see the other guys. Says about breaking a Hawaiian's nose, shoving the bits up into the brain. The old chopping stiff arm, he says. Big Don G's a satanically tough motherfuck. This was his assessment. Said the way he heard it, you could fight like you was born in a bar fight. I tell Glennie, I say, I'm sure you'll be proud to hear him say it.
Gately was trying with maddening, sinistral care to write out, hurt? Dead any? Finest? Who hat in hall? More like drawing than writing, when without warning, one of the day shift trauma MDs sweeps in, radiating brisk health and painless cheer. Gately remembers dealing with this one MD some days ago in a kind of gray post-surgical fog. This MD is Indian or Pakistani and is glossily dark but with a sort of weirdly, classically white-type face you could easily imagine profiling on a coin, plus teeth you could read by the gleam of. Gately hates him.
So, I am here with you again in this room, the MD sings, kind of, when he talks.
The name in gold piping on his white coat has a D and a K and a shitload of vowels. Gately almost had to reach up and swat this MD after surgery to keep him from hooking up a Demerol drip. That was between, let's say, 4 and 8 days ago. It's probably but for the grace that his crocodilian sponsor, ferocious Francis G's, sitting here, watching blandly when the Pakistani MD sweeps in this time. Plus, they all have this flourishy MD way of sweeping Gately's chart up off their hip and holding it up to read it. The Pakistani purses his lips and puffs them out absently and sucks off his pen a little.
Grade 2 toxemia. Synovial inflammation. The pain of the trauma is very much worse today, yes?
The MD says to the chart. He looks up. The teeth emerge.
Synovial inflammation. Nasty. The pain of synovial inflammation is compared in the medical literature to renal calculus and ectopic labor.
Partly it's the darkness of the classic face around them that makes the teeth seem so high-wat. The smile widens steadily without seeming to run out of new teeth to expose.
And so you are now ready to let us provide the level of analgesia the trauma warrants, instead of Toradol, simple headache ibuprofen. Which these medications are boys doing a large man's duty here, yes? There has been reconsidering in light of the level, yes?
Gately is inscribing an enormous vowel in the notebook with incredible care.
I make you aware of synthetic antipyretic analgesics, which are no higher than category C3 for dependence.
354.
Gately imagines the MD smiling incandescently as he wields a shepherd's crook. The guy has that odd, clipped, sing-song way of talking, of skinny guys in loincloths on mountains and films. Gately superimposes a big skull and crossbones over the glossy face, mentally. He holds up a palsied, page-high letter A and brandishes it at the MD, and then brings the notebook back down and swiftly up again. Spells it out, figuring ferocious Francis will step in and set this ad man for the disease straight once and for all. So Gately'll never have to face this kind of Pakistani temptation again, with maybe nobody supportive here next time. C3 his ass. Fucking tall one C3 too.
Automorph SR for an instance. Very safe. Very much relief. Fast relief.
This is just morphine sulfate with a fancy corporate name, Gately knows. This rackhead doesn't know who he's dealing with or what he's.
Now I must tell. I would make the personal first choice of titrated hydromorphone hydrochloride in this case.
Christ, this is delauded. Blues. Fackelman's Mount Doom. Kites, steep angle decline as well. Death on a Ritz, the Blue Bayou. Gene Fackelman's killer, by and large. And also Gately pictures good old Nooch. Tall, skinny Vinnie Nucci. From the beach at Salem, who favored delauded. And spent over a year without ever taking the belt off his wing, dropping through Osco's skylights at night on a rope, with the belt all tight and ready just over his elbow already? Nucci never eating and getting skinnier and skinnier, until he seemed to be just two cheekbones raised to a great silent height, even the whites of his eyes finally turning the blue of the bayou,
and Fackelman's eliminated map after the insane scam on Sorkin and a disastrous 2 nights of Delauded, when Sorkin...
Though I say yes, this in truth is a C-tool medication, and I wish to respect all wishes and concerns,
the MD half sings, inclined at the waist now by Gately's railings, looking closely at the shoulder's dressing, but not seeming at all disposed to even touch it, his hands behind his back. His ass is more or less right in ferocious Francis's face, who's just sitting there. The MD doesn't even seem to be aware. 34 years sober, ferocious Francis is there. And Francis isn't making a peep. It also occurs to Gately that esoteric is another ghost word he's got no rights to throw around, mentally.
For I am Muslim, and abstain also by religious law from all abuse of compounds as well, the MD says. Yet if I have suffered trauma, or the dentist of my teeth proposes to perform a painful process, I submit as a Muslim to the imperative of my pain, and will accept relief, knowing no established religion's God wills needless suffering for his children.
Gately has made 2 shaky smaller A's together on the next sheet, and is stabbing emphatically at the sheet with his bick. He wishes if the MD wouldn't shut up, he'd at least move, so Gately could shoot a desperate, please jump in here, look at ferocious Francis. The drug question has nothing to do with established gods. The MD's bobbing a little as he leans, his face coming in and then receding.
This is a grade 2 trauma we are looking at in this room. Allow me to explain that the discomfort of right now will only intensify as the synovial nerves begin to reanimate. The laws of trauma dictate that the pain will intensify as healing begins to commence. I am a professional at my job, sir, as well as a Muslim. Hydrocodone bitartrate.
355.
C3. Levorphanol tartrate.